This is another iRaw podcast.
To sum it up, cosmopolitans think that all individuals globally are the primary subjects of moral concern, and that we have principles of justice that are global in their scope. So we shouldn't think about justice as being something that just pertains between citizens within one nation, but rather we can think about justice as being something which is global in reach. And in much of the literature, with only a couple of exceptions, the primary units of moral concern are assumed to be human.
Welcome back to The Animal Town, everyone. This is season 6, episode 2. In this season of the podcast, we're focusing on animals and politics. And I'm delighted today to be speaking to Angie Pepper about cosmopolitanism. You're going to hear me stumble over that word a whole bunch over this episode. I don't know what it is about some letters that my mouth just can't deal with, but cosmopolitanism is one of them that I have to think a bit about before I say. It's a really important concept and something that I realized prior to having this conversation, I didn't know a lot about, or I had a very superficial understanding about. So I was very happy to speak to Angie Pepper more about it today. A little bit about Angie. Angie Pepper is a senior lecturer in philosophy at the University of Roehampton in London. She has a philosophical background in contemporary political philosophy, applied ethics, normative ethics, and feminist philosophy. Her recent research focuses on what we owe to other animals. She has published papers on the place of non-human animals in our theorizing about global justice and on what we owe them as a matter of climate justice. She has also defended the following claims, among others: that sentient non-human animals have the right to privacy, that few non-human animals are political agents, and that sentient non-human animals have the right to self-determination. Angie's latest projects focus on the normative significance of non-human animal agency. In other words, what other animals do and why it matters morally, socially, and politically. She's especially interested in whether domestication is compatible with animals' interests and self-determination. You can find out more about Angie Pepper on her ResearchGate page, and she also regularly contributes to the political philosophy blog Justice Everywhere. I'll make sure that there are links to those in the show notes as well. Again, a really interesting conversation, and you can get a sense that we really get into the thrust of things. About halfway through, we get quite excited. We delve quite a bit into speaking about pets and the politics of pets. And I know that pets have come up a lot in the podcast, in the history of the podcast. So clearly a really important and pertinent topic, especially when thinking about animals and politics. I hope you enjoy. Welcome to the Animal Town podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm delighted to have you on the show because we're going to be speaking about a concept that I know comes up all the time. So I'm from kind of geography and I read a fair bit of geographical literature, and sometimes the word cosmopolitics comes in and out of the frame. And I've got to admit that I'm not always entirely sure what it means. So I'm really excited to learn a bit about what cosmopolitics is from you today, as well as kind of why politics in general is important when we're thinking about animals. But before we get into that, maybe we can learn a little bit about you first and how you came to be interested in animals and politics.
Okay, great. So I guess the story is that I was doing my PhD on the topic of feminism and global justice. And I was interested in how thinking about gender injustice would make a difference to our theorizing about global justice. And so one of the things that I argued in the thesis was that cosmopolitans, well, feminists should be cosmopolitans about global justice, and cosmopolitans should be feminists. So that was the basic claim. And we'll come back to what exactly cosmopolitanism means in this context. But very briefly, as the project went on, I got more and more concerned about the anthropocentric bias in that literature. So I guess to sum it up, cosmopolitans think that all individuals globally are the primary subjects of moral concern, and that we have principles of justice that are global in their scope. So we shouldn't think about justice as being something that just pertains between citizens within one nation, but rather we can think about justice as being something which is global in reach. And in much of the literature, with only a couple of exceptions, the primary units of moral concern are assumed to be human. And so by the time I was getting to the end of the project, I started to think, why, right? Like, why is it that we should only care about humans when we're thinking about justice and global justice? And the main sort of motivation, you know, the sort of the grounds of my concern was that actually justice is really about well-being. It's about protecting and promoting individual well-being. And since, you know, we share this planet with many other sentient animals who have the capacity for well-being, then we should be concerned about how our actions and our institutions are affecting them, not just the ones who happen to live within our nation state, but globally. So, and that was the start of it, really. And I've continued to work on issues to do with animals and politics since then.
So you found your way to kind of animals through like feminist scholarship and looking at feminist literature and scholarship?
Yeah, and also disability theory. So part of my project, I started to become concerned about who exactly the cosmopolitan individual was. So who is this subject of justice? And so asking questions around what counts as a person, right? Who are people? And thinking about personhood as a sort of moral category, and looking at disability theory. Lots of disability scholars have been very critical of the concept of personhood for being exclusionary and for thinking of persons as only being, you know, fully rational, for example, fully autonomous. And I think that it was through reflection on that that made me think, hang on a minute, there's something really problematic going on here with sort of the global justice literature in general, that it depended upon a certain view about the cosmopolitan individual. And to be fair, most cosmopolitans have a very expansive conception of the human subject. So they don't want to exclude vulnerable humans, including children. They want to include them. But nonetheless, they only talk about humans. And so there is a kind of species bias that creeps into that literature.
This is so interesting because it makes me think of, I'm going to go blank on the name of the book, but was it last year or the year before? Oh gosh, something beyond entanglement. I'm going completely blank now and I'm about to ask you a question, but in essence, this was an animal studies scholar. She was saying that this idea that we can include everyone all the time in all places is actually kind of challenging because if you want to lay claim to any sort of, I guess, principle or say like this is right or this is wrong, that necessarily includes some kind of exclusions and inclusions, some sort of in-group and out-group. So am I correct in understanding that cosmopolitans don't want to create these divides? They want to say that everybody has a claim to, I guess, some entitlement or to being, I guess, treated with dignity or whatever it is.
Yeah, so that's right. For cosmopolitans, the basic thought is that, you know, everybody's interests matter and they shouldn't be excluded just because they happen to live somewhere else, right? So a person shouldn't have their interests discounted when we're thinking about justice because of their nationality or because of their race or because of their gender or because of their disability. And I would argue, in addition, because of their species, right? So that's the general thought. And of course, the more interests that you have to take into consideration, the more difficult things get. And there are going to be issues around trade-offs. But when we're just thinking about who is the community, right, of subjects that we should be concerned about, right, whose interests should feature in our deliberations, the cosmopolitan says everyone, right? You don't get excluded just because you happen to live beyond our nation state's borders.
Would organizations like the UN be an example of cosmopolitanism, or is that not really the case because it's still nation states that are kind of representing their own interests?
So I guess it might be helpful to introduce a distinction, although philosophers like to introduce distinctions. So I'm primarily interested in moral cosmopolitanism. So this is a claim about the status of individuals the moral status of individuals, and it feeds into the kind of political, right, insofar as we do have to count everybody's interests when we're thinking about how to organise our political and social life globally. But political cosmopolitanism is slightly different because it does ask questions about which kinds of institutions, right, we ought to have. So should we have something like a more robust version of the international institutions that we currently have, or should we have something that looks a bit more like a kind of world government, right? So the kind of more concrete questions about the institutions are not something that I've really worked on. I've mostly been interested in this kind of moral claim about who gets in, right? Who should be included in our considerations about justice? Is it even possible to have principles of justice which are global in scope? Because some people just think that it's not. Justice only gets going in political communities, right? And there is no global political community, so that no questions of justice arise. So for me, like, that's, you know, where a lot of my focus has been, on thinking about the scope of justice, who's included, and really trying to widen out the scope from not just thinking about justice as it might pertain to the nation state, but thinking about it globally, and then thinking about the inclusion of all sentient animals within the community of subjects of justice.
Wow, that's a massive, massive task. It's really interesting. So I spoke to Josh Milburn in a bonus episode a few prior to when this one will air, and he spoke about kind of justice as well. And I hadn't really, you know, justice is one of those concepts where everyone thinks that they know what it means, but the closer you look at it, I try to define what is justice, and it just seems like, it seems inescapable somehow. It's just like I somehow know something is just or unjust. But obviously that's quite shaped by cultural norms, by the society or the community that you're in. So how would that kind of influence, like, is there a center at all to a cosmopolitan worldview, right? Or does this emanate from, like, I guess I'm trying to understand how you're locating the cosmopolitan, like, where are the actors in here? Or is it a matter of everyone is an actor that's acting in their own interests? Or is it just a matter of we're trying to understand the general idea of how politics is structured and who is included and excluded? And I'm thinking it's the latter one.
So I think it's closer to the latter, but it's really about, it's slightly more conceptual. So it's a question about whether justice is, as I said, something which only can obtain between co-nationals. So one sort of traditional definition of what justice is comes from John Rawls. And so he was interested in distributive justice at the level of the nation state. And so justice for Rawls is about the distribution of benefits and burdens that emerge out of our system of shared cooperation. And so in order to have a just society, we need to make sure that the benefits and burdens are distributed fairly amongst citizens. So it shouldn't be the case that some individuals are burdened, right? They're carrying many more of the burdens than others, and that some are getting many more of the benefits. So if you think about access to resources, access to opportunities, rights, freedoms, like, all of those things are like the benefits that come about from us living together. And so on that kind of traditional sort of liberal understanding of what justice is, it is about making sure that the benefits and burdens of our social cooperation are shared fairly. And I guess that I'm sort of sympathetic to that understanding, because individuals have entitlements of justice, right? We think that as individuals, we're entitled to, for example, adequate nutrition, we're entitled to clean drinking water, we're entitled to sanitation, we're entitled to education, we're entitled to healthcare. Like, these are the basic things that we think are going to make a human life go well, right? And so as a matter of justice, like, when we're thinking about justice, we're just trying to make sure that everybody has got what they're entitled to, and that if there's any inequality, that those inequalities are not unjust, right, or unfair.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I think you use the word well-being here in a really nice way. So this idea that, because, you know, you were listing a whole bunch of entitlements there, and then at some point I was going to be like, well, who entitles us? What is the entitlement? But I kind of at the end there, you noted, well, it's a matter of principle in terms of justice that you're entitled to that, because you are entitled to well-being or a good life, I suppose. And I really loved in your paper that I read on cosmopolitanism, I really loved how you used well-being, this idea of being well, which again, it's one of those words that I use all the time, but I don't like think about it. Well-being is the ability to be well. It's not the ability to be really rich or to have everything you want, or it's almost the idea of having enough. And like you say, so I'm assuming if there is suffering and we're all subject to suffering, are some of us suffering more than others? Or is that suffering unfair? And I like fairness a whole lot. Is that closer to kind of the sense of what you're saying?
Yeah. And I think that we, you know, in the case of suffering, we want to know what's the cause of this suffering. You know, is the cause of this suffering institutional, right? That it's a result of the way in which we've chosen to organize our social world and the institutions that govern our lives. And so, yeah, when we're interested in well-being, we are interested in promoting the interests of people such that they can live well, that they can live good lives, and that we are also diminishing the possibility of suffering, right? We can't eradicate suffering from the lives of sentient animals, right, including humans. It's a feature of what it is to be sentient. But nonetheless, we can ask questions about why it is that somebody's suffering. In many instances of injustice, their suffering is caused, right, by other humans. And, you know, even if it's not deliberate, but perhaps a consequence of the ways in which certain institutions have emerged and developed, nonetheless, we can rectify that injustice by organizing our social life differently.
I'm guessing there isn't one theory of cosmopolitanism. I'm going to end up saying that wrong a whole bunch of times. You mentioned, at least in your paper, that there are these two kinds of ones. You've got relational and non-relational cosmopolitanism. Could you perhaps just walk us, and we'll come to animals in a moment, because I know that this is central to kind of the argument of interspecies justice, or at least of kind of cosmopolitics. But what are... So I understand so far that cosmopolitics in general is kind of much bigger in scale, in scope. It's extending beyond kind of group categories and saying that we need to kind of dissolve these group categories and assume that all individuals should live well. And the distribution of that should be fair in terms of who gets to live well, how. So kind of at that broad idea. But how we achieve this, I guess, is different, or how we conceive of this is different. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about this, like, relational and non-relational view of cosmopolitics.
Yeah, good. So earlier I mentioned John Rawls, and I said that for Rawls, when we're thinking about justice, we're interested in the distribution of benefits and burdens. And you have a just society when the benefits and burdens that come about for our shared cooperation are distributed fairly, right? So that's the kind of the core of that kind of view. And relational cosmopolitans essentially take that position and they transfer it to the global level. And they say, look, we're locked into schemes of cooperation with others globally, right? So we shouldn't think that justice only, that the nation state is the only circumstance in which questions of justice arise, because we don't just engage with people who live in our nation with us, but actually with people across the globe. And so globally, there is a system of interdependence. We're very dependent on what other people are doing elsewhere in the world, both in terms of being able to access certain goods, but also in terms of their institutions potentially affecting us, right? So it might be that, you know, especially if you think in the context of climate change, right, what individual countries are doing makes a massive difference to the lives of people elsewhere in the globe. And so the relational cosmopolitan effectively says, look, because there is so much interdependence and the fact that we have shared institutions, like you mentioned the UN earlier, but you might talk about the World Trade Organization or the World Bank, you might think about more regional institutions like the EU. There are all of these institutions globally that are governing, right, our lives. And so there is something, right, that is beyond the nation state, which ties us together and can ground duties of justice and principles of justice, which are global in scope. So it is appropriate for the relational cosmopolitan to ask the question, how do we distribute the benefits and burdens that arise out of this global system of interdependence and cooperation. And we shouldn't just think about how justice operates with, at the level of the nation state. So that's the relational cosmopolitan. The non-relational cosmopolitan says, your entitlements of justice shouldn't depend upon your belonging to a certain scheme, right? So the non-relational cosmopolitan thinks that irrespective of whether you're part of some system of shared cooperation or interdependence, you nonetheless have entitlements of justice. And for many of those people working in that literature, it's in virtue of the fact that you are a human being and that you have human needs that you are a subject of justice. And if somebody else can help you meet those needs, then they have a duty to do so. So it doesn't matter that the two of you are not in the same scheme. It doesn't matter that you're not engaged in some kind of cooperation. If my well-being is suffering because I don't have access to adequate nutrition, or perhaps because I'm the victim of some kind of natural disaster, and you have the ability to help me, right, then I have a claim against you and you should help me if you can, right? So for the non-relational cosmopolitan, justice doesn't just get going, or questions of justice don't just arise when we're locked into some kind of scheme with one another. They arise just in virtue of our capacity for well-being and because we are fragile and we have these needs that need to be satisfied if we're to avoid having bad lives.
It's interesting how many, like, I think knee-jerk kind of reactions I wanted to have to the things you were saying. And I can't quite justify those kinds of reactive impulses, but like part of me, when you were speaking about like I have a duty to kind of respond, and I would argue yes, like if I see someone in need of help and I am in capacity to help, I should help. But then at the same time, again, maybe this is because of how we view the nation state, you get a lot of people kind of putting up boundaries and borders and saying, well, why should I care about someone else in a country that's not my own? Why should I? And it's not a worldview I subscribe to, but it's one that I'm sympathetic to and that I understand that people want to kind of protect their own. So I think I get the kind of non-relational one, because you can see how if you're only thinking across nation states or across particular groups, that can also create some sort of resistance, I think, to giving justice to those that are not in your group. But it's interesting how there's this idea of like trying to compare suffering, I suppose. Like, is the injustice done to me and the injustice done to you comparable? And then if they are comparable, are we starting to get into some sort of like calculation as to whose life matters more? And that seems to me to be moving away from justice in some respects.
So you're completely right that we live in a world of borders and people are very attached to them. And the observation that non-relational cosmopolitanism is going against that, right, is right. They want to see the erosion of borders and the recognition that actually the borders that are in place are not as kind of solid as people make out, right? So actually the reality of geopolitics, the reality of our interdependence upon one another on the planet, we should not lose sight of that. They're really pushing this idea that there's a real problem with this kind of state-centric thinking, which leads us to be in a really poor position to deal with what David Held calls governance gaps at the global level. So if you think about, you know, how are we going to tackle climate change? What do we do about global pandemics? How should we deal with or address the internet, right, and the potential problems with the internet? These issues are global in scope and no one nation can tackle them on their own. There needs to be a collective effort. And so the non-relational cosmopolitan is kind of in that spirit of like saying, look, we need to think beyond borders. But it's also true that people do have, right, quite strong feeling of attachment to their co-nationals and a sense of perhaps sometimes patriotism, like national pride, belonging. And that comes often, at least for some, with a desire to exclude, right? So to keep the club just to be ours. And I mean, I think one thing that's worth saying is that being a cosmopolitan of either stripe, relational or non-relational, doesn't entail saying that you don't have any stronger duties to your co-nationals or that you don't have any duties to them at all. What it's saying is that you can't prioritize your co-nationals and kind of treat them as the only subjects of justice, right? You have to think about everybody in the world. And again, if you think back to what I said about inequality, right, if there is unequal treatment between the co-national, right, so thinking about the members of one community and the rest of the world, what justifies that, right? Can you justify prioritizing your co-nationals? Now, in some circumstances, the answer will be yes, right? But you can't prioritize them to the detriment, right, of people elsewhere in the world is the basic thought. So cosmopolitanism says, yes, you can have duties and principles of justice which are global in scope, but it also doesn't preclude there being principles and duties of justice which obtain at the level of the nation state. Right? So it does not necessarily entail that.
Excellent. I think I'm with you now. And it seems to me as though it's just calling for a bit more sensitivity and a bit more kind of expansiveness in thinking about who we owe. And we as a big we, whether that's we as decision makers or I guess even as consumers or as people in our own communities, to think more broadly about who we have a responsibility to and who we, and you know, a good example maybe too, because we were having kind of this really big discussion, but let me know if this kind of rings true with what you're saying. So in the early days of COVID, so I was living in Kingston, a small town in Ontario, and I think this happened in several kind of towns and cities. Obviously, everything was closing down. A lot of local businesses were struggling, right? And there was a big call to buy local, support local. And this was kind of done without question. People were like, yes, you need to support your local community. And I understand the impetus to do so. But at the same time, I actually found myself resisting it a little bit because I realized that in trying to privilege our community businesses at that time, we were precluding several global businesses that were reliant or international businesses that were reliant on us engaging with them. And some of them would be hit even more devastatingly by the pandemic. They didn't have necessarily the same national resources as Canada had. They didn't necessarily have the same kind of purchasing power as Canadians have, for example. So in trying to, and this obviously muddies things, it ends up feeling like, oh, I can't make, I'm damned if I do and I'm damned if I don't. But if I'm hearing you correctly, kind of a cosmopolitan worldview is one that's saying, I need to think more expansively about what my actions do and who it impacts, because it's not always the obvious answer. It's not always buy local equals good, or for example.
No, I think that's right. And of course, you know, in that case, there are added levels of complications, like insofar as you might think, well, buying local might be better for the environment. I mean, there are questions there, but like there are going to be multiple reasons pursuing particular actions. But I think that you're completely right in that example that there is something of the cosmopolitan mindset which says, hang on a second, right? Who is going to be like most disadvantaged by our actions here? Like who is in a more privileged position, perhaps, like who is going to be better protected by existing institutions? Who is going to be disadvantaged if we, you know, if we pursue this course of action over this other course of action, and not necessarily prioritizing those who are closest to you. And I think, yeah. So yeah, it's a good example.
Great. And perhaps now we can switch to kind of thinking a bit more directly about how animals are included in this kind of idea of cosmopolitics. Because I think you've said now in general, when folks talk about cosmopolitanism, and it's kind of interesting that you've got a group of folks that are saying all individuals should be considered, all folks should be considered. We should think about how our institutions impact others or all of us differently. But you mentioned, I think twice now, that animals have kind of been excluded from these considerations, that it's just kind of taken for granted that when we're speaking about who an individual is, that's human.
So that's right. And I think that the problem persists in analytic contemporary political philosophy. I think that the cosmopolitans are still writing about global justice and they're still writing about it from a human perspective. Only humans get in. And I think that, you know, the more that philosophers engage in discussions of climate change, very similar trend there, that when we're thinking about climate change, we just think about its impact on human life and not animal life, or only animal life insofar as it might affect humans. And so I think that, you know, in those kind of early papers that I wrote on the back of like realizing that there was this big problem with my PhD and like this whole body of literature, the sort of aim for me was to try, right, to get people who I was engaging with to recognize that actually you can't just make this assumption. There is no good justification for it. If you're a cosmopolitan, it's particularly difficult, I think, to say we only care about human well-being. We only care about the interests of humans. You have to, what could be the rationale for that? And I think that for that reason, it's a natural, as a theoretical framework, as a way of thinking about what justice is and what justice demands, it naturally extends to all sentient non-human animals. And once you include them, that's going to make a massive difference to how we think about the actual kind of practical implications of these theories. And I mean, as I said earlier, I'm more interested in the kind of the theoretical framework. But once you have that framework in place and you start thinking about things like climate change, then it, you know, it becomes necessary to start thinking, okay, what does justice, what does global justice demand in the case of climate change? So what does climate justice demand? It demands more than just thinking about how humans are going to adapt. Right. It requires that we also start thinking about how we're going to help animals adapt. And so, I mean, that's just one example. We might think about environmental degradation in general. We might, you know, lots of questions around the trade of animals across borders and like what kinds of institutions we're going to try to bring about to prevent a lot of the wildlife crime and trafficking. I mean, those are just kind of cases.
I could certainly see how this would have, you know, huge, just thinking about what you're talking about in terms of the global, you know, the global interconnectedness, right? You start to realize that animals' bodies and animals alive and dead are moving across the world all the time, constantly, which if their needs, if they start to be taken seriously as individuals, and we start to think about, you know, the World Trade Organization that you mentioned, all of a sudden they have a lot of different questions to answer to in terms of whether their actions are just, whether the policies they have in place to facilitate those movements of animals is just.
So, I mean, I think that part of the, you know, this is always a slight problem with the sort of philosophy or the sort of philosophical project that I'm engaged in here, which is just that, you know, in a way, this is a work in ideal theory, right? We're thinking about like what the world ought to look like. So we're thinking about how we should set up the framework, and the framework has to include non-human animals. But the world in which we live, right, that world is so far, far away. And so the question when, you know, we're trying to get to that ideal, like, where do you start? It's a whole different ballgame. And it like requires very, very different solutions. But nonetheless, you know, we should always be guided by this thought, right? That justice is something which is owed to individuals globally, including sentient animals. And that should shape what we're doing, right? It should shape how we are constructing our global order. It should shape these kind of patterns of interdependence.
I think I've brought it up in a couple of episodes now, but this, you know, One Health came up in the last season where we were looking at, you know, biosecurity. And of course, you've got sustainable development and One Health. And just the current conversations going on at the World Health Organization are definitely including, I think, animals in a way that's never kind of been done before. Animals are on the agenda. People are talking about One Health. They're talking about animal health. Of course, it's been done with a kind of lens to serve humans. And this is where the big concern comes in, is it's not just enough. Justice is not just achieved to have them on the agenda, right? It's how they're included that really is important, whether their interests are taken into consideration. And yeah, and I guess this then starts to raise some questions between like welfare and rights. And yeah, it gets really messy and tricky. And of course, the bigger the scale, you're talking like global connections, the more complicated it gets.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that the complications in part become tricky because of cultural diversity. So the value that different political communities put on certain practices involving animals, also economic diversity. So some nations are really, 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 really dependent, right, on exploiting animals in order for humans to meet, to subsist, right? So they're not even flourishing. So there are all kinds of issues about how we operate in a world to reduce exploitation and oppression and the abuse of non-human animals in ways that don't also contribute to exacerbating the suffering of already vulnerable humans. So there's all of these issues where there are kind of competing demands, and we need to navigate them in ways which are just. I think that that has to be your guiding thought, right? Can we really justify treating individuals, whether it be animals or humans, in this way? Can we justify the continuation of this particular practice? What's the rationale for it? And oftentimes with animals, we can't justify it, and we have to find other solutions to supporting humans who perhaps are dependent on practices which exploit them, exploit animals. But yeah.
What's all around you, almost everywhere you look, and makes your life better? Birds. Learn all about these beautiful creatures in this wonderful new podcast called Birds of a Feather Talk Together. Two experts guide two newbies on their journey to learn more. Mallard ducks, ivory-billed woodpeckers, Hawaiian honeycreepers, blue jays, cardinals, sandhill cranes, and more. Each week we discuss a different bird and walk away with a better understanding of the birds all around us. Oh, and we have a ton of fun doing it. Listen now. You're going to like learning about these birds. I guarantee it.
I think that's really well said. You know, I feel, and I know that you said cosmopolitan, maybe this is a different kind of political lens, operates at the global level, but I wonder if could you apply this kind of lens even within a city, for example? So let's say you are a cosmopolitan in a city, it seems appropriate. That's always what I thought a cosmopolitan was, for someone who lived in a city. Anyway, ignore my ignorance. So you're in a city and you're a governor of a city, right? And you have to make, because cities are arguably some of the biggest contributors to climate issues and to the consumption of world resources. So they're really important places, I think, in terms of thinking about justice and whose needs are being served how. But now you could imagine the governor of a city, kind of how differently their urban agenda would be if they were tasked with not only thinking about their city, but other cities, and that they were not only tasked with thinking about their human residents, but also thinking about, you know, other animals that move through or live in the city, how differently those policies would come to bear, right? How fundamentally different I think the city would look, how different the infrastructure would look if you thought not only about, I mean, even this idea of like human animal, there are so many different types of humans, so many different types of animals that you start to see just a different city emerging. And just to kind of go from that global scale to city scale, where I think, yeah, you could imagine overpasses for animals. You could imagine better ramps in buildings, you know, like it becomes a lot more obvious that thinking more broadly about what an individual is or who an individual is can facilitate real world changes, even if it's not overnight, right?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, in my own work, I've kind of moved away from thinking about questions of global justice to thinking more about domestic justice. So thinking about our relations with animals who we live with in particular. So I'm especially interested in domesticated animals and especially interested in companion animals. And, you know, at the moment, yeah, I'm kind of preoccupied with this question of like, what does a just society look like when we live with animals? Like, how should we organize our social and political world in a way that ensures that they get what they're entitled to? And so one key question there is like, what are they entitled to? What are our current animal companions entitled to? And so, you know, one thing I guess that I've sort of become doubtful of is the usefulness of this concept of interspecies justice. I think that part of my worry is that it suggests a kind of mutuality that does not actually exist between us and non-human animals, particularly domesticated animals, that there is some kind of reciprocal relation of justice, that, you know, we can kind of construct a just society together. And I basically have just come to doubt that that's possible. And I'm not sure what the replacement label should be, like multi-species justice, you know, that's kind of fine as well. It doesn't suggest this kind of mutuality. But I think that, you know, all of this is I'm kind of on a path to thinking that actually what justice requires for at the domestic level is really a matter of humans really taking a step back and reflecting on our practices. Like, how did we get to where we are? What are we doing with these animals? What are these animals entitled to? Is it good for these animals to continue to be with us in the ways that they are currently?
Those are really, I think, challenging questions, because it's interesting, this idea of like multi-species and interspecies, right? Because I think sometimes when we write about these issues, we maybe use them a bit interchangeably, but they do kind of show a different way of thinking about the relationships. The one is just to multiply and say that there are many, whereas the other is saying that there is this interrelationship. And I certainly think animals, they tell us often what kind of just system they would like, right? They resist certain things, they move in particular ways, they, you know, chomp down specific things that really give a sense of what they think they should be entitled to, but then the other side is, I guess, our propensity to create our own stories, and two, our kind of, I guess, willingness to listen to what it is they're trying to say, and also our varied interpretations of what they're trying to say. But then that, to me, just says politics, right? When we have varied understandings of what we are all trying to say. But I hear your, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know where I sit on this kind of spectrum of things myself, but I certainly do think that there is scope to listen and pay attention to them in a way that doesn't position them as commodities or things. And as soon as you start to view them as kind of individuals or even as communities or as beings worthy of justice, I think how we interpret their behaviors shifts fundamentally.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, something that's important in what you said is that it's not altogether clear that we can figure out what their entitlements are on the basis of their expressed preferences, because they might have preferences which are really problematic. And we think that actually, like, you know, no, you can't do that. Either it wouldn't be good for somebody else or it wouldn't be good for you. So just having kind of preferences or just being resistant to something isn't enough to give us a clear indication of like what just entitlement is. And if you think about the discussion we were having about cosmopolitanism, right there, we were thinking about justice as being connected to well-being. So one way of thinking about the entitlement of the other animals with whom we share our political communities is to think about, you know, what is in their interest. And you're right, answering that question is also very difficult for us because we are not particularly good judges of what is in the interests of other animals. But nonetheless, we can start to think, okay, what is good for them? Like, what would help them to lead a good life? And I think that once we start asking those questions, it does become very difficult to think about whether we're good for them. I guess that's perhaps a different way of putting it. Like, are we always good for the other animals with whom we share our lives? And I think that, you know, I'm more and more, you know, skeptical of the thought that we are. I think that there's, even in our ideal case, right, even when we love them dearly, I'm not sure that it is good for them, that we're good for them in the long term.
We might be good for some of them and not good for, and they might be good for some of us, and it might be, and this isn't even differentiated according to species, right? Like, I read an interesting statistic the other day that said, I think it's something like 2/3 of the world's dogs are free roaming dogs, you know, so it's actually extremely rare for a dog to be a pet. Most dogs are living outside, they're living their own lives. They often have, I think, challenges that come with being a free roaming animal that might call for different cities or different spaces to kind of respond to perhaps health needs, etc. but they're free roaming. And these free roaming dogs versus pet dogs face different challenges, even though we're speaking about the same species, right? And maybe there are some dogs who the free roaming lifestyle would be a better suit for them, but there are other dogs where a kind of pet lifestyle would be better for them. But again, I think breeding them to suit our lifestyle is certainly clearly indicative of a wrong, right? The idea that we can just make animals suit our needs and our homes and our desires so much so that they can't even reproduce on their own. We're literally manufacturing them with our own devices. Just points to me that that's clearly not in the dog's best interests, because they end up living really painful lives I just don't think it's in anyone's interests, really.
No, and I think that's right. And I think that, you know, what you say about the number of free roaming dogs is interesting. And I think that it's kind of interesting to also put it in comparison with the number of animals who are pets, right? So I think that, you know, current estimates are that, you know, just over half of the world's population of humans lives with a companion animal. So, like, there are a lot of pets out there. And of course, not just dogs. Or cats, rabbits, reptiles of one kind, you know, I mean, just lots and lots of pets, right? And I think that, you know, like you, I've become very interested in the politics of pet keeping and in our understanding of that relationship. You know, how should we think about it? Can you transform that relationship from something that is really deeply problematic to something good? And I think that the answer is probably not, because I think that there is something just problematic with the asymmetry in dependency, power, and vulnerability, basically. That
I think, you know, I got Linus, my dog, we got him three years ago now from a shelter, right? And he existed, I think, within a society where those were the options for him, right? Be a pet or be in a shelter. And there were no other options. And I think Paula Akari mentioned it on the show not too long ago, where she said, you know, we have very little clue what actually goes on behind closed doors. And this is the same kind of arguments that were put forward when it came to children's rights many years ago, is that we need, and I think many children go to school and will have other adults in their lives that could potentially speak on their behalf. Dogs are often very, very isolated. You are their person. You dictate the entirety of their lives, whether it's a good life or a bad life, how much they're stimulated, when they can pee and poo, at least in our kind of. So yes, I think kind of having this background in animal studies and now living with Linus and being acutely aware of how much his world is shaped by my desires, even though I'm in this camp, right? But then I think of I did field work in Botswana a few years ago, and at this point I wasn't even like in animal studies or paying attention to animals really in any sort of significant way. They were just in some ways background noise to what was happening. But I've always looked at animals, if you know what I mean. And these dogs didn't live in people's homes, but they kind of had this way of choosing a family and staying in that yard and then leaving. And they moved through the city space or the village space in their own way. But they were kind of like, they weren't pets. They were companions, actually, probably in a more real sense of the word. They were companions.
So I think that's really interesting. And I've started to think that liminality, right, or thinking about liminal animals as those animals that live around us but not in our homes, is a better model for thinking about what the just multi-species society would look like for all animals. That, you know, when you observe, whether it be the magpies in the tree outside or the foxes in the yard, that's what it should be like for all animals. They should be free. And they shouldn't be so bound and constrained by our whims and just so vulnerable. I think that it really is the vulnerability which I think puts a block on the justification for having that kind of relationship. We can justify it in the here and now, right? Because the animals are too vulnerable to be, you know, set free. But it is a question about where we're heading. And the numbers of pets are just rising and rising and rising. And the trend is global. And it's a kind of, I think that for me, the moral urgency of it is like really kind of ratcheting up. And I think that the problem is being obscured by our love for them, like this, just this desire to want to have them, to be able to touch them, to be able to communicate with them, all of the good things, right, that are true of those kinds of relationship. I don't want to deny that those good things are there, but they, I think, serve to obscure this relation of dominance and the costs of that relation of dominance to the animals.
I think that's really well said. Do you know the book Dominance and Affection?
No.
I think you would absolutely love it. It's Dominance and Affection, the Making of Pets. It's by an early animal studies geographer. And I think he speaks about pets and pethood, not just in terms of what we think of as traditionally pets, like dogs or cats, but he also speaks about at this time, like how some women or children could be like that pethood is not just this idea of constraining or keeping or treating in a diminutive type of way is not. It's really an excellent book.
No, it's really helpful. So I was going to say, so one other thing that I think is really important in this. So, you know, I've been presenting a little bit of this work over the last couple of years, and a lot of people are resistant. So most people, you know, people who should be sympathetic, or you would hope you would be slightly more sympathetic, are just not sympathetic. And quite often people want to make this comparison between animals and children, right? And I think that like there's just something so deeply problematic with like the comparison. Pets are not children, for one. The ways in which we will power over children are not unproblematic, so we shouldn't just think that like that's all fine, it isn't. But for many of our pets, I mean, part of the problem is that we want to keep them in this kind of frozen state of dependency for a lifetime. Like there's no, they're not going to grow up and go on and do something else with their lives. Like that's not why we get them. We wouldn't want pets who moved on, right? I mean, I think that's part of like the kind of the what it is to be a pet, right? It is to be a creature that it is not going to have that kind of life. And I think that there is all kinds of problematic stuff going on there around, you know, as you said, we don't know what animals are capable of, but for many pets, whatever capacities they have are stunted by the ways in which they're socialized, the processes of domestication. And so it's not like childhood and it's not like children. We're preparing children for a free life. And with pets, we're doing the opposite. We're essentially creating creatures to be mastered. And I think that it's that, right? The politics of that, which, it casts doubt on the idea that we could have a just society and live with them in that way.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating, I think, conversation. And again, this speaks to some of what you were saying about in terms of cosmopolitanism. So to come back to that, you know, even in terms of thinking about the international, we spoke about it being as a global kind of consideration. You look at the number of animals that are moving, you look at this idea that it's, yeah, like there are people saving some dogs in a country and shipping them across the world to feed, in effect, a particular kind of want to help these dogs. And it's not to say that anyone is bad in wanting to do this. It's not, I fear that sometimes when we have these conversations, there's this impulse to say that that is bad and that is good. I think questioning the system of having pets is one that we need to question, because I think it was Kritika Srinivasan who said to me, you know, it's actually, keeping pets is really recent and it's really quite strange. And it's very much a Western idea, because most of the world, you know, let's say 100 years ago, didn't keep pets. Pets are a relatively recent thing. So yeah, I think, I mean, gosh, I could speak about pets for days and days, but it seems to me that this is definitely, you know, in the realm of questioning the imbalance of, what did you say, Rawls said, the distribution of costs and benefits and...
Yeah, that's it, the benefits and burdens. Yeah, and I think that for pets, there's a lot of burden. And, you know, there are some benefits for them. And again, like it's made tricky by the fact that there are animals here and now, right? We have to take care of those ones. But when you take a step back and think about the practice, right, the question is, like, are we do is this something that we should be looking to close down because it's fundamentally not right?
Yeah, and the implications roll on. If animals can just leave our homes when they want to leave their homes, like you see these stories of people that created doggy doors so that they're, because they live in societies where free roaming dogs are allowed, the dogs come and go as they please. That's a very different type of life where the dog is choosing you again and again and to come into your home and again and again. You know, if I was in an abusive relationship and I chose to leave or I chose to stay, you know, these raise interesting questions, but I have at least some support or some options available to me to make. I mean, that's a whole, I'm opening up a whole different can of worms here, bringing in because we're not even speaking now about direct abuse, right? It could be the most banal, we're not speaking of, it could be the most ordinary, everyday, you're a good dog person by all standards, you do the right thing. Is this a practice that we want 100 years from now, if we're looking at dogs and cats and guinea pigs and et cetera, as individuals with their own interests. Goodness, okay, we're at an hour already and I haven't even asked you your quote yet. This has been so, so interesting. Do you have a quote ready for us?
I do. So my quote is from Gary Francione's Animals as Persons, Essays on the Abolition of Animal Exploitation, which was published in 2008, I think. And the quote is from page 164 and I will read it out. Our moral discourse about the human-non-human relationship seeks to resolve conflicts between humans and animals. But we create these conflicts in the first place by bringing animals into existence for the sole purpose of killing them or otherwise using them exclusively as means to our ends. Moreover, the overwhelming proportion of our animal use involves human interests that are trivial relative to the animal interests at stake. So, I mean, I read this, you know, many years ago and... You know, I think for a long time, I was probably guilty of thinking, you know, of assuming that the practices or something about the relationship. So thinking about, you know, animals who we work with, right? Like maybe there's some forms of animal labor that we can make right by changing the laws and changing the policies. And we can make companionship right by changing the laws and changing the policies. And if all of the questions around, oh, what should we feed our companion animals? Or what should we do about cats who kill birds? And, you know, all of these questions. I think what Francione is saying in that quote, which I keep coming back to, is like, hang on a minute, right? These perceived conflicts are only conflicts because of the fact that we've manufactured them. If we had ceased doing what we're doing with animals, these questions wouldn't arise. So again, you know, when we're thinking about cosmopolitanism and we were asking, you know, difficult questions about, oh, you know, this group of people depends on the exploitation of animals. So maybe we should, you know, continue to let them do that because if we, you know, take away that option for them, it's going to be a tragedy for them. But notice that a conflict is only a conflict because the practice exists in the first place. And I think that so much of our thinking about animals and what justice requires is it kind of occludes that fact that actually a lot of the problems that we face, like how should we fund shelters, like how should shelters deal with all of these overwhelming numbers of animals that they've got, similar questions with sanctuaries, like all of these issues are issues because we've created the problem by having all of these particular animals, you know, in society with us that we have made, right? It's not accidental. They did not come into existence by accident. We have created this problem. And I think that, yeah, so that's why I chose the quote. And yeah, it's probably quite clear.
I mean, it's a really poignant quote, I think, but it's also challenging in that it's to, you know, I agree. We kind of create conflicts. We're in this kind of loop of problematization and solution building, right? Like, oh, there's a problem, let's fix it. There's a problem, let's fix it. And each, like imagine that as a spiral almost. And each time we have a problem we seek to fix, we actually create a new set of conflict areas, right? So, because I don't think we can dial it back. We're not going to go back 15,000 years and, you know, de-domesticate cows. And I'm not sure that I'm necessarily in the camp that would say, you know, all animals that are now born of our relations should now just completely cease to exist. I still need to think through this, but I don't think that I'm in that camp. But at the same time, even if there's no, because I don't think we can go back to some romantic past. I think we're where we are now, and there are all of these animals that exist right now. But the reason I like that quote is it's a matter of what new conflicts are we currently creating that we're going to seek to try and put fires out to tomorrow. And I think factory farming is a really good example here. You know, you just look at the progression of how factory farm became a factory farm. They started to consolidate the number of animals kept in a place. So the amount of shit increased. And then they were like, what do we do with all of this shit? So they created manure lagoons. Now manure lagoons have created algae blooms. And they're like, what are we going to do about all these problems? Now they're trying to create cows that don't create the particular type of poo, and that's going to create a different problem. So I think we do, because we don't stop to think, I think we just constantly seem to like want to be responsive, that we do tend to create more and more conflicts that tend to actually exacerbate more and more kind of violence done to animals and other people, right?
And I mean, I think that, you know, to just, I guess, to bring it back to pets, because it is what I'm interested in at the moment, but similar things arise around what we feed them. Right. So the amount or so not just what we feed them, the bodies of other animals, but like the amount that they need to, you know, we're talking about very, very large numbers now. And so the climate change implications are quite big. And if that number is just going to keep rising, right, we're creating more of a problem than we needed to have. Because we could have just resisted it. I mean, for me, that's not like the main argument against keeping animals as pets. But I do think that we just do not stop and think. It's not just about having them and loving them. They require food, like you say, like farmed animals, they produce waste that needs to be disposed of. And that is just growing and growing and growing. And similar problems are arising. Like, what do we do with that? The pet industry, right, is billions and billions and billions of pounds annually. And a lot of that is like plastic bowls and beds and like all of this kind of paraphernalia, which is contributing to, yeah, the general costs, climate costs of keeping a pet. And, you know, again, it's just, if it's something that we could just not do, we have a choice, right? It's not that we find ourselves in this situation where these animals are just going to keep growing, you know, multiplying in number. And we don't have any control over that.
No, you're exactly right. And I mean, I think that this is an argument many vegans would make, because we have a choice about what's on our plate. We also have a choice about who's in our homes. I mean, I will still say that I think there is something different when you adopt a pet versus buy a pet. But this, I mean, you could make a counter argument there in terms of still feeding a desire, right? And still maintaining a kind of sense of wanting to have these animals. But I think if you're contributing to the kind of propagation of breeding, that, like, I do think that these are slightly different, even if they're still part of the same industry.
In other work I have on animal shelters, I think that this is like really, is really interesting. And I'm not actually sure what to think about this. It seems that actually, given the pressure that shelters are under, that if you can take an animal on, you ought to, right? Because you want to minimize the number of animals who killed in shelters, and we want to support the staff so that they are not overburdened by all of these animals that need rescue, but they've got limited funds to or resources to do so. But at the same time, I think you're right that the more people there are out there with pets, the more we normalize this idea that pets are something that a person, I mean I don't want to say this, but I think it's true. I think that people believe they're entitled to pets, that it's almost a right. And you see this when you have debates around shelter adoption policies, which are exclusive, right? So we get claims that actually they are systematically unjust against certain marginalized groups of humans. So everybody should have a right to a pet, right? Even a shelter animal. So we need to have inclusive adoption policy so everybody gets to have one. Similarly, debates around pet licenses. So if you make it the, you know, having a pet becomes something which is a privilege in society that works to the disadvantage of marginalized communities, right? Again, I think the assumption in there is that everybody has a right to a pet, right? You shouldn't, you know, be excluded from having one. And that, again, it just, yeah. So if you're, even though you could be doing an honourable thing of taking a pet from a shelter, you are perpetuating, I think, this idea that, yeah, you want a pet, you're entitled to one, go get one, right? Like that's the, that I think is the attitude of the day. we have not shown that, right? If you think about our earlier conversation about justice, justice is about what you're entitled to. And I don't think, right, as a matter of justice, people are entitled to have pets, right? That is not something that I think that we have a claim to.
I guess someone would then ask, though, are dogs and cats, because of their histories, entitled to homes, right? And maybe that's positioning it slightly differently, and maybe it's imagining the ways in which they have access to homes differently. Because I think that then if we apply this cosmopolitic, like, I don't think it has to mean an end to human-dog relations or even dogs in human homes, but I certainly think that there are some things that need to be challenged and questioned quite fundamentally about how the absolute control we have of one animal for their entire lives and the extent to which they can make a choice to do otherwise is that doesn't exist, right? They have no choice other than that. So yeah, do they have a claim to having homes because they've been their legacy? And this, again, not all dogs, right? 2/3 of dogs are free roaming, but depending on where you are, dogs in those places have become accustomed to a particular way of being. Now, is this just a really sneaky way to justify keeping pets because we want them? I don't know. But
well, I think, again, we can draw like a line between those that are here now, right, and those that don't exist. And we can say, look, those that are here now do have an entitlement to a home, right? They need adequate care and love, and they need their needs met. Like, I'm not opposed to that at all. What I am opposed to is the thought that we can just keep going, right? Bring more and more into existence because we believe that we have an entitlement to them. That's the only reason. It would be weird to say that, you know, well, they in fact have, those that do not yet exist, right, have an entitlement to be brought into existence. That I'm not convinced by. And part of the reason I'm not convinced is because, as I said, I think that the relationship between pets and their guardians, or, you know, even put nicely, companions, animal companions, are they human companions, right? There's something fundamentally problematic about that relationship as it stands. And your vision of, you know, a free roaming community of dogs who get to choose, right? That's great. And I'm on board with that. But it is not where we're at. And I would probably want to even resist, like, saying that those dogs were companion animals in that sense, right? Because they don't belong to someone. They're not like that. I think that's the thing that I, yeah, want to resist most strongly, this sense of like the proprietary nature, right? If even companionship, right? That's my companion who lives here with me and will never leave.
Yeah, and is often actually bought and sold. Like I do, I mean, property. I remember early days of my animal studies degree, I really didn't understand the kind of difference between like the idea of why property was really even more, I think, central than commodity. The idea that something is owned. It's different. Okay. I'm going to just keep talking to you forever and ever and ever because I can feel us. We're really getting into a ball now, and we're going to be here until, you know, whatever time. It's been so delightful talking to you. Before I let you go, do you want to you've told us a little bit now that you're looking at domestic animals. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about what you're working on? And if folks want to get in touch with you about what you do, how they might be able to do that?
Yeah. I'm working on this issue of domestication. I'm particularly interested in the relationship, the structural dynamics of the relationship between us and pets. And I'm interested in whether it's possible to take that relationship as it stands, which is currently tyrannical, right? So we do not have legitimate authority over these creatures. Is there a way of like transforming that relationship such that the power inherent in it is legitimate? And I guess it's probably going to come as no surprise that I think the answer is no. And that, you know, existing attempts to show how we can have companion animals in the just society, I think fail because they don't really address this structural problem. And you can call it something else, right? You can call pets companions. You can describe the relationship in different ways. You can change the laws and the policies, but ultimately the asymmetry in vulnerability, dependency, and power that exists there cannot be legitimated, on my view. So that's where I'm at. And if anyone wants to contact me about this, my email is angie.pepper@roehampton.ac.uk, and you can probably just Google me and find me online.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show and for giving so generously of your time and for dealing with my novice questions about cosmopolitanism. I really, 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 really enjoyed talking to you today.
Yeah, it was great. And thank you for the book recommendation. It was a lot of fun.
Hi, Virginia. Welcome back to the Animal Highlight.
Hi, good to be here again.
Mm-hmm. And who are we talking about today?
You and Angie spent a long time discussing what being cosmopolitan means, and you were very honest in saying that prior to encountering cosmopolitics, your personal understanding of cosmopolitanism related to those who live in cities. And I have my own association of the cosmopolitan with cocktails. So the cosmopolitan's a famous cocktail, and I wanted to be a bit playful with this animal highlight by thinking about an animal in relation to an alcoholic drink, and then more seriously relate this to what Angie was talking about with respect to cosmopolitanism and multi-species justice. So I want to talk about the tequila worm, the worm that's sometimes found in a bottle of tequila. And there's so much to say here, but definitely the first thing to say is that the tequila worm isn't a worm. The tequila also isn't tequila, but we're not here to do a drinks highlight, we're here to do an animal highlight. So we won't go into the tequila mezcal question, we'll focus on the worm, or rather the caterpillar, because what people are actually referring to when they refer to the worm is a caterpillar. But just to be even more confusing, the caterpillars are called red maguey worms. So something which we might usually think of as a caterpillar because it's the larvae of a moth, we actually call a worm. But I just wanted to make it clear that when I say red maguey worm, I don't want people to think of what they might usually think of when they think of a worm. I want them to think of a caterpillar.
Got you. So a worm and a caterpillar are not the same thing.
No, they're actually different species. Worms are invertebrates, and there are lots of different kinds, including earthworms and parasitic worms, like roundworms and flatworms. Caterpillars are insects. But the maguey worm isn't the only caterpillar to be called a worm. There are quite a few others, and a common one is the inchworm. But going back to the red maguey worm, it feeds exclusively on the agave plant from which tequila or mezcal is made. And there's another caterpillar which eats this agave plant, the white maguey worm. But while maguey worms eat the agave plant, they in turn are eaten by people. And if we think about the idea of cosmopolitanism and interspecies justice, which you and Angie were discussing, we might think of this as the first breach of justice in relation to the red maguey worm. People consider them a food animal and turn them into a commodity. We might think about justice for the red maguey worm as involving moving from a system where they're eaten to one where they're granted rights to not be exploited by humans. Angie pointed out, however, that when considering multi-species justice, in some cases where people are reliant on animals for their subsistence, either for food or labour, a transition period might have to be considered where human exploitation of animals is phased out gradually rather than stopped abruptly, since a sudden change could result in considerable disadvantage to people, possibly even constituting a breach of their rights. But the red maguey worm isn't only exploited as a food source. In a case of metamorphosis, and we'll come on to its life cycle in a minute, it's morphed from a valuable food source into the tequila worm. And this change is a further commodification of the red maguey worm, and one that's even harder to defend, since through its role in the drinks trade, it's exploited purely to gratify human wants rather than needs, both for financial gain for the drinks trade and as a statement for those who participate in the drinking culture surrounding the tequila worm. But I wanted to talk about the life cycle of red maguey worms and the incredible metamorphosis which they and other caterpillars like them undergo. I've mentioned that the red maggot worm lives on and eats agave plants. They grow and develop for up to a year until they're ready to make a silk cocoon. They then pupate for about 6 weeks, after which they emerge as a moth. Then the moth lives only a few days, during which time the female lays her eggs on agave plants, which will hatch into caterpillars for the process to begin again. And given the potential of the caterpillar, something which is utterly different from any human capabilities, we might consider a cosmopolitics which recognises the right of the caterpillar to pupate and metamorphose into a moth, rather than ending up at the bottom of a bottle for human gratification.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's a life stage. It's like cutting someone off before puberty and saying, you know, that whole part of your life is unimportant. I mean, and this is putting aside the idea of killing and consuming the animals. I think, like you say, the potential to become something. And the what kind of moths can they become, or do they become?
So I could only find the, I think, Latin name for it. They're a small grey moth, and I believe it's pronounced or something like Comadia redtenbacheri.
That sounds better than what I was going to say. I was going to say Comadia redtenbacheri. So Baccarai, I think, sounds much more professional, because I just looked them up now. They're quite beautiful, really. Like, for me, it looks like a quintessential moth, right? With those four like gray, white type wings, and they're quite fuzzy and fluffy.
Yeah, I probably was a bit dismissive calling them grey, but perhaps silvery. Really, they look really velvety.
Yeah, they do.
And soft.
And they're kind of small. I was reading that they're about 12 to 15 millimeters. Maybe that's big for a moth, actually. Yeah, that's not insignificant, actually, if you think about it, for a moth. 12 millimeters. Although I'm really bad with math, so I don't know if what I'm doing with my fingers is actually a good indicator of the size of the moth.
Isn't it interesting that, you know, was it Heard who said that, you know, we recognize animals when they're big like us? So we're talking about whether the size of a moth makes it significant or not on an entirely human scale. You know, if it was 12 centimeters, we might consider acknowledging it more than if it's 12 millimeters.
That's a really good point. And I'm happy you brought insects into the animal highlights so early on in the season, because I think insects are often neglected when we speak about animal highlights. And just the other day, I was speaking to my husband, Oliver, about, you know, when you think about the physiology of an insect, how much is going on in something that tiny, you know? And again, I'm bringing in size, but I think it just blows my mind to realize that you've got a whole system and a whole body working and a brain and everything happening at a scale that we can't quite comprehend, which I think is pretty remarkable.
Well, and the fact that they metamorphose, you know, something we tend to have that, we have that tendency to measure things by human standards, don't we? Oh, can they use tools? Can they communicate verbally or with language? And if a non-human animal can't do that, then we dismiss it. But it's just the benchmark we're using. If we used a moth benchmark and said, well, can other animals go through this process of metamorphosis, humans would fail badly on that test.
But it's interesting because, like, metamorphosis is a kind of physiological change, right? And I think all animals do go through certain physiological changes, but they don't, their whole bodies don't change. They don't cocoon themselves up and come out from being a crawling being to being a flying being, which is pretty darn radical. I just wanted to say that I'm really delighted that you brought them up, also because I think the consumption of insects is a really important matter that's being discussed increasingly now. A lot of people concerned with climate change, for example, are saying, well, we need to look into how we can make use of insects to create food and food to feed human populations in the future. And on the other hand, you've got a whole bunch of kind of philosophers and ethicists coming forward and saying, hang on, what do we really know about the social lives of insects and their sentience? Can we do this in a way that is ethical and responsible? Or are we just creating a whole host of more exploitative industries?
That's a really good point because, yeah, I think there is a real rush towards insect protein as we try to move away from a more carbon-intensive agricultural system. But there's huge amounts of work now on the sentience of insects. And I think we dismiss them too readily. As we were saying, they're small and to from a human perspective, perhaps insignificant. So, and I mean, the moth we're talking about today and the caterpillar we're talking about today perhaps even aren't the best examples, because they're still quite charismatic from an insect perspective. You know, there are, if we think of ladybirds or ladybugs, whatever people like to call them, you know, we tend to like them, but just because they're charismatic and they appear in children's storybooks. And we like moths and butterflies because they're beautiful. But we have very different attitudes to other forms of insects. And I think the ones that are commonly considered as potential for food are ones that, yeah, we wouldn't consider charismatic and would be very, or potentially comfortable to eat if we were comfortable with the idea of them being edible.
And also just to bring forward kind of the cultural dimensions, which I think you're pointing to here about the tequila worm, or the misnamed tequila worm, is how much it's attached to different, like the consumption of insects is also attached squarely to quite different cultures, different heritages. You know, you travel across Asia, you are encountering insects in a wide range of cuisines. So sometimes I think in the West, we have this idea that the consumption of insects is like this new and novel thing that's happening right now. Same thing with I think protein, alternative protein and meat consumption generally. People are like, wow, it's so new. And you're like, hang on. They've been, you know, in China, they've been creating fake meats for a long, long, long time. And across Asia, there's been consumptions of a variety of insects. So it's interesting to think how the animals are kind of positioned within food systems historically. But still, I think what you're talking about with the worm and what we're talking about here with the insects is this kind of industrialization of eating insects. You know, we were just looking before the show that it's a $97 billion industry, the tequila industry. So how are the worms kind of caught up in this? Or how are the caterpillars caught up in this? Are they just accidentally harvested, or are they actively inserted into bottles? Do you know?
No, they're actively inserted. It's not something I've ever seen, but you know, you will have a bottle of mezcal and there will be a caterpillar at the bottom of it. And the idea is you're supposed to drink it. And apparently it's a relatively new thing. It's not as if this is something that's, you know, embedded in cultural histories. And I don't know enough about it in Mexico where it originated, but certainly in the West, you know, there's a lot of machismo in the drinking culture around this, which is associated with tequila more broadly anyway, and the kind of drinking culture that we have.
It's interesting to think about how these different animals kind of get caught up in consumption and a variety of consumption. Anyway, I'm getting sidetracked with thinking about insects and consumption. Really incredible caterpillars. And for anyone interested in metamorphosis and how caterpillars become butterflies and moths, maybe you can give me a lesson on how it happens, but I'm going to go and do some reading about it now. Maybe you should too. Thanks so much, Virginia. Thank you, as always, to Animals and Philosophy, Politics, Law and Ethics, Apple, for sponsoring this podcast, to Jeremy John for the logo and Gordon Clark for the bed music. Thank you to Christian Mentz for editing this episode, and to Virginia Thomas for the wonderful animal highlight. This is The Animal Turn with me, Claudia Hurtenfelder.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's IRoarPod.com.